Well, let's dive right in. We actually have a lot to cover this morning. We're not going to cover half of what I'd hoped to cover, but we're going to try to cover, what are hopefully, some important points from this story, the story of Noah's flood that we introduced last week. We're taking 2 weeks to go through Genesis 6 through 9 and discuss this really very famous story of Noah and this worldwide flood. Just a reminder for you kids, for you 7 to 12-year-olds, we will have a kid's question again later in the sermon, and if you answer that correctly, you'll get a prize. It's an action Bible this week, and so you can win an action Bible, 7 through 12-year-olds, and you can just be paying attention. Again, it's going to be another number question, just like last week, and so you're going to give me a number that I'm asking for. Okay, well, let's catch this up. What are we doing right now? We're teaching through the early chapters of Genesis, Genesis 1 through 11, believing that these chapters are really foundational, and that in these 11 chapters, we are presented with some really, really fundamental ideas that the rest of the Bible is built upon. And so we wanted to establish ourselves in these ideas. And so last week, I shared a brief list of some of those ideas that we had pulled out of Genesis chapters 1 through 5. Let me share that list again. In those first five chapters, we learned that God was there in the beginning. That seems obvious, but that's really important. God was there first. God created out of nothing. Loving relationship came first because God in himself is loving relationship. Humans were created in the image of God. There's some continuity between God and human beings. Male and female together reflect God's image. God gave the human stewardship over the earth and said to take care of it. And seven, humans disobeyed. And that changed everything. And so we saw each of those things in those first five chapters. There was more. There was more that we learned from those chapters as well. There's so much, actually, in these chapters. But those are some key points. But last week, we started going through Genesis 6 through 9 and again, Noah's flood. And through that story, we added a couple more points to our list, and here they are. Number 8, the human heart is inclined toward evil. And that is how Noah's flood starts out, describing the state of humanity at that time. And what it says is that every intention of the heart of man was evil continually. And it just described this very corrupt world of humanity. And we also talked about how the people of that time are not entirely different than we are. And that our hearts are inclined toward evil as well. There's something in us, there's this disease, this cancer that runs through our veins that inclines us towards selfishness and evil. And so we're not entirely different. And then secondly, we learn that God pours out his wrath on evil. And of course, that is what is so striking about this story of Noah and the flood, that God flooded the entire world as a punishment for all of that corruption. So God pours out his wrath on evil. And those are difficult truths. You know, those first seven truths, we can perhaps receive those and we can really align ourselves with those, but these two that we learned last week, they're the difficult ones. It is difficult to grapple with this possibility that there is this evil inclination in my heart and that God judges evil. Okay, that's pretty sobering, and there should be a bit of a weight and even a fear that is stirred in us when we understand those things. But of course, that's not everything from this story, and we're going to add another truth to this list as well. So we're talking about Noah and his flood, and one of the questions, of course, that we started out with last week was, well, did this really happen? You know, was there actually a flood that destroyed the entire world? And you know, there are different views on that and Christian views within the church. And some would say, yes, absolutely, there was a literal historical event and it was global and it destroyed the world. Others would say, well, there was a literal historical event, although it was more regional, it was more of a local flood. And some would say, well, actually, this is allegorical, and it was intended to communicate certain truths about ourselves and about God, but there wasn't necessarily a literal historical event behind it. And so I tried to briefly lay out some of those views, but then also shared that I am in that first camp, and I believe that there was an actual historical global flood. And last week I gave some reasons for that. These were the theological reasons. So they were the textual reasons. When I look at the Bible and consider what it shares about God and us and the gospel, I am persuaded to believe that this was an actual historical event. And so I tried to go through some of those reasons last week. And I also shared that this week we were going to touch on some of the more observational, scientific, historical evidences or reasons to believe that there may have actually been a flood, that this is describing real history. And so for the first part of this morning, before trying to draw out some of the principles from this story, we are going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about, okay, is there reason to actually believe that this happened? Or is this just craziness? Is this just such an outlandish fairy tale story that we couldn't possibly believe it? Well, I think there is reason to believe that this actually happened. Now, a lot of it depends upon what you make of this, really. You know, when you see this, what do you see? And you see all of these layers of rock. Sedimentary rock, and it's laid down one on top of the other, and you ask yourself, what is the history behind this? Okay. And was this laid down over long periods of time? And there was a layer of sediment slowly laid down, maybe at the bottom of the sea, and it was laid down and laid down and laid down, and then there was some environmental change, and maybe it stopped for a while, and then another layer in a different way was laid down on top of that, and it kept going and going and going. And pretty soon it hardened, and this layer of rock, or these layers of rock, emerged. And so that is one option, or the other main option is this was laid down catastrophically through lots and lots of water and pretty quickly. And a flood washed over this area, and it deposited sediment, and then it was hardened pretty quickly, and it washed over again and deposited another layer of sediment, and it kept building and building and building this series of layers. And we ask ourselves, what happened here? Is this age, or is this flood? Now, I think there is actually reason to believe that this is age. It's why it's the majority view, the vast majority view. People look at this and say, now I think this was a long period of time that created this. There is reason to believe that, and I think I don't even want to be, I think regardless of position, sometimes we can be very dismissive of somebody from a different position. And I want to acknowledge that there are reasons to believe in these different positions, and you can look at things from one angle and say, yeah, I think that's age. Because of course, this series of rock layers kind of translates into, you've seen something like this geologic column where these layers are categorized and dated. And it's thought that these layers represent really hundreds of millions of years in different periods throughout that time. And you can look at that and you see those layers and you say, yeah, I think that sounds reasonable, that they were all laid down over these long ages. And in addition to that, not only do you just look at the layers and maybe intuitively think, yeah, this is age, but then you also look at the fossils associated with those layers. And it seems like there's this progression or this development of life where at the bottom in those older layers, there is less complex life, and then it evolves as it goes up the column into more complex life. And that seems pretty compelling. And then you add on to that the dating of the rocks in these layers, and certain methods of dating seem to demonstrate very old ages, again, hundreds of millions of years. And you add all of those things together, and it seems pretty compelling. And it seems like an open and shut case that this was age. And again, I believe that there's some validity there. And there are some things to consider. And as I look at some of this, I am challenged. Okay, I consider a lot of these different ideas and evidences, and I can be challenged by them. And sometimes it looks like it's indicating this way, and sometimes indicating this way. And so there's certainly complexity here. And I also ask myself, should I even talk about this? I do not have a PhD in geology. And I have a master's degree in environmental engineering. And there was certainly science in there, and there was chemistry and physics and microbiology and those sorts of things. But I never analyzed and categorized rocks. And what I've learned even more recently is that there are a lot of rocks in this world. And rocks are complicated. And you don't think that they are, but they're pretty complicated. And this is a huge topic. And part of me says, well, should I just stay in my lane and not even approach this topic? Well, I think it needs to be entered with a fair amount of humility and acknowledging a lack of expertise. And yet at the same time, I do believe that we can still examine and study and dig into some of these things even without formal training, and we can get a general understanding. Also, it's sort of overwhelming when you start considering some of these topics that relate to the Bible, and they relate especially to creation and these early events described in Genesis 1 through 11, you realize that there are so many fields of expertise that are necessary. You know, to understand physics and cosmology and paleontology and microbiology and biology and all of these things and geology, none of us can be an expert in all of them. But I think sometimes we can be in a position where we can try to dig and gain a general understanding of a variety of these different topics and then provide a means of kind of synthesizing those. And I think it's reasonable for a voice from within the church that is looking through a biblical lens to try to offer input and try to offer an interpretation of some of these things. So I've tried to study and understand some of this more and more, although I realize there's still a long ways to go. You know, sometimes you read a book or two about a topic, and then or maybe you hear a presentation or two, and you feel like, I got this. Like, yeah, this seems pretty clear. And then you read another book or two and hear another presentation and you realize, wow, this is huge. And it somehow becomes a lot more fuzzy. Well, that's certainly happened to me, but I've tried to push through that and tried to, again, come to a little bit more of an understanding here. And so hopefully I can speak with some credibility. So we're gonna talk about some reasons to consider the possibility that this really happened. And I am going to talk a little bit about the layers and about the fossils and about the dating and give some other reasons as well. But before we do that, we're actually just going to read. And we're going to read a long section in the middle of our passage here that describes the flood. And so you can turn there, turn to page 5. And we're going to read the part in Genesis 6 through 9. We're going to read the part that describes the actual flood. And then we're going to try to imagine it and then see if it's reasonable to consider this as a historical event. All right. Chapter 7, verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, On that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Noah's wife and three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast according to its kind, and all the livestock according to their kinds, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and every bird according to its kind, every winged creature. They went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those who were with him in the ark, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed. The rain from the heavens was restrained, and the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the waters had abated. And in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days and sent forth the dove, and she did not return to him any more. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Then God said to Noah, "Go out from the ark, you and your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. All right, let's first just summarize the timeline for Noah's days on the ark. Okay, let's start with day one. Day one, the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven are opened. Okay, so this is the start of the flood. Then, of course, it rains for 40 days. So on day 40, the rain stops, but waters continue to prevail is what it says. So the indication is that the flood is still going and still growing, perhaps. Day 150, the waters begin to recede. Okay, it seems like that was the peak of the flood. Also on day 150, it seems like the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. But then there was a wait. Okay, so 74 more days after they had grounded themselves, the mountaintops became visible. Then there's another 40 days, it seems. And at that point, Noah opened a window, and he sent out a raven and a dove. Then a week later, Noah sent out the dove again. And then a week after that, he sent out the dove one last time. But then there's more waiting. And it's not until day 314 that Noah removes the top of the ark. But then he waits another 56 days. And he was just sitting there in the ark, covers removed. He can look around, probably sees a lot of dryness. But it wasn't until day 370 that God commanded Noah to leave. He was waiting for God's command, and then he left the ark. Okay, so there's the general timeline that these chapters give us. And then we might ask, okay, well, what might have been happening if this really is a description of history? Like, if this really happened on the earth, what can we presume? And, so, and of course, some of this is speculative, and we don't really know what was happening, but we might be able to imagine it. Of course, it was raining, and it was raining for 40 days, and that was significant. And so if it's raining for 40 days, and it's presumably raining pretty hard for 40 days, that's going to have an effect. But perhaps the bigger contribution to the flood was the bursting of the fountains of the deep. And apparently, there was some great source of water from under the earth or maybe under the ocean floor that burst and began spewing water. And so perhaps the ocean floor splits open and waters arise and burst and fountain up. And of course, if that's happening, there's all kinds of stuff that's going on. There's tectonic activity and there's volcanic activity. And so things are moving. But say those waters burst open and the fountains burst open in the middle of the ocean and it creates all of this activity and huge waves, tsunami-type waves, begin to be created and begin to pummel the land. Okay. And maybe there was just one supercontinent. Of course, that's generally believed, whether you believe that our present-day continents moved apart very slowly or very quickly. The thought is that they were once all together, and so maybe there was just one continent. But in any case, those fountains of the deep burst forth, and those waves begin to pummel the land. And perhaps the waves come in, and they crash into the coastal regions, and they strip a lot off of there, and deposit sediment, say, and then another wave comes in, and it does the same thing, and it washes back and forth, and it slowly moves up, maybe moves up in altitude. You know, perhaps where we're told the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 2 was probably elevated. There was a river that came out of it. It split into four rivers. And perhaps the Garden of Eden was elevated in altitude. But in any case, perhaps this flood slowly moves up in altitude until it covers the entire land, 15 cubits deep over the highest mountains. But it does that for, it seems like, the first 150 days. Okay? After those first 150 days, then things start to recede. And what's happening there? Well, there's probably still a lot happening and going underneath each other, and mountain ranges may be forming, and ocean floors are dropping down. And as that happens, maybe huge sheets of water are peeling off the continents. And there's erosion and deposition and canyons being carved, perhaps in this later stage of the flood and even after the flood ended. So there's probably just this complete rearrangement of all the geography. If this really happened, what is described here, that was probably going on. And so then the question becomes, can we believe that? Is there any reason, any evidence to believe that that might have actually been happening? I'm going to share a handful of reasons, but just a few. I'm not going to go into great detail. I even just this morning was cutting things out. I'm like, I can't share all of this. So some of this I'm going to go through very quickly, just skim over. All of it, I'm just going to give a quick summary. I'm just sharing a few points that I think are probably the easiest to understand with a very succinct presentation here. Okay, so this is just whetting the appetite and really just encouraging consideration of some of these things. So last week I shared a handful of reasons about why I believe, theological reasons why I believe that there may have been a global flood, and this week I'll share some scientific and historical reasons. The first, I'm going to share five. The first three will be more under the scientific umbrella, and the last two more historical. And these first three, the scientific category here, we are again going to talk about the layers and the fossils and the dating here. So we'll start with just the layers. Let's take a look at these layers. So if we see this column here and these pancakes stacked one on top of each other, you know, is there any reason to believe that a flood actually laid them down? Well, I think there are a handful of reasons. Number one, just the flat contact between these strata. And so again, these pancakes laid one on top of the other. And they are very flat. There are these very crisp, distinct lines between the various layers. Now, it is interesting that even modern sedimentation rates, the rate at which sediment is deposited, are pretty high, meaning that if things were going at that rate, there should actually be a lot more rock. These layers should be a lot thicker and higher. And the idea is that there was probably some gap, there were gaps in time. And so a layer is laid down, but then for whatever reason, the sedimentation stops, and there may be this big gap in time before it happens again. And so there is a lot of time missing here is the theory. But if that's so, the thought is that there would likely just be a lot more evidence of those long periods of time. There'd be a lot more erosion or soil formation or evidence of animals burrowing in these layers. Just the reality that so many of them are so flat, so crisp, seems to indicate that maybe these layers were laid down pretty quickly one after the other. Okay, so that's one thought. Secondly, large coverage areas. And it just seems like there are these sequences, they even call them mega sequences, of sedimentation or these sequences that have a lot of continuity and they can stretch continent-wide, perhaps even worldwide. And it just seems like a lot of this was laid down all together, very quickly, very widely. So it covers a lot of area. Again, I'm going through these very, very quickly. So this is just, again, whet the appetite, then go dig or consider. Thirdly, just these deformation features. And you see these kinds of things in various areas where these rocks are bent and formed like this. And you know, of course, if these layers were laid down over millions, hundreds of millions of years, and then some event happened to uplift them, of course, intuitively, you think, well, they're not going to bend like that. Okay, they're going to crack and fracture, and that's going to be pretty clear. In reality, rocks can, under extreme pressure, temperature conditions, they can become more plastic, and there can be, in some way, a bending. However, as I understand it, there is evidence of that. So if there is this metamorphosis that rocks go through, there is evidence both to the naked eye and molecularly of that process happening. And as I've tried to read up on that, it seems like there's not really that evidence. And it seems like there's a lot of indication that if these bent, these layers, they bent while they were still soft. And so that's the theory. And you know, there's so much again here. And I can wonder, okay, what's the explanation on different sides? And this seems so compelling if you present it this way, but then there's this explanation over here, and it can get so confusing. You know what's kind of nice lately? We were given AI. She can probe a little bit. You can say, well, what's the response to this? And what's the response to this? And I did a fair amount of that this last week. And there are all kinds of explanations, different sides. But I was actually surprised at how much things like this and other things that I'll get to are certainly a challenge for those who would believe in sort of the conventional way of thinking here. And I was actually surprised at how when I would probe and prompt and ask questions that oftentimes there was a little bit more of a validity given even to the global flood position. But in any case, you can go probe and try to discover and think and read, but these kinds of evidences at least should get us wondering, okay, was there really flood that came through here? So there's some of the evidence just looking at the layers. Next, let's quickly look at the fossils. Again, this feels pretty compelling. When you look at that fossil record, it just seems like there's that progression of complexity and the development as you move up the fossil record in the geologic column. Now, what's the explanation for that, for those that are flood proponents? Well, the idea would be that there's not necessarily complexity that is emerging or developing, that there's complexity throughout the column, and that it's more a representation of a progression through varying ecologies. And so again, the thought is that the flood and its destruction begins maybe in the depths of the sea, and initially it affects all of those marine creatures that are hanging out around the trenches down there, and then it's going to move up, and then it's going to affect the coastal regions and the low marshy areas, and then move further onto land and then continue to move up. And so the theory is that it's progressing through these various ecologies rather than demonstrating a progression of the development of life. I've had to ask myself, can I buy that? Okay, could that really have been what was going on? And again, I think there is reason to believe that maybe, yeah, that could be an option. But let me give you a few other reasons as we look at the fossil evidence, what kind of evidences might indicate that a flood was happening. First of all, there's just the sudden appearances of creatures. And of course, maybe the most famous one of these or that you've heard of, just the initial one, would be what's been called the Cambrian explosion, and just at the very bottom, seems like all of a sudden there's a lot of life. Like there wasn't really much, and then there was a lot. And there is a fair amount of complexity even in that life. And so there's this sudden appearance of a lot of complexity. But even as you go up the column, there are other creatures that seem to very suddenly appear, and then sometimes they'll suddenly disappear. Often they'll suddenly disappear. And often there are not the precursors to those sudden appearances that you might expect. And so you look at that and say, well, there may be something there. Secondly, rapidly buried fossil graveyards. And you know, it's hard to fossilize something. That seems to be the case. Because all kinds of things can happen to organisms after they die. You know, the soft parts of organisms, they can rot or be eaten, and the hard parts can be dissolved by water, or they can be broken and crushed and scattered by scavengers or storms can affect them, and they have to be buried. They have to be buried pretty quickly and become part of the rock, and even the process of burial can really damage things, and groundwater can seep in and dissolve things, and earth movements can crush and rearrange, and even if a fossil survives and is eventually exposed to the earth's surface, it's very unlikely to be found and collected before it's destroyed by weathering or by erosion. And so it's hard to fossilize things. But we do see, again, these very widespread collections of fossils. And fossils of large animals, and it seems like that would have required a lot of water and a lot of sediment very quickly. Just read a quick summary from Andrew Snelling. He says, the frequent occurrence of fossils, especially in large accumulations called fossil graveyards, suggests specialized conditions repeatedly on large scales. However, it is virtually impossible to find specific present-day depositional areas where fossils are forming that are analogous to the fossil deposits found in the rock record. Land animals, amphibians, or fish, whole bodies or just their bones may occasionally be trapped in sediments and buried, but this is not a normal or frequent occurrence, even where mass destruction and mortality occurs in some localized catastrophe. Usually, the bones remain in land or sediment surfaces until they gradually disintegrate. So again, it's rare, but we see these very extensive fossil graveyards. Thirdly, there's the tracks or the ephemeral or the short-lived markings. These are tracks of animals or sometimes even droplets, like raindrops, that are preserved. And this also just seems to indicate that these things, they happened, get in wet sediment, and then they were preserved very quickly. And so all these kinds of markings that we see over and over, they just seem to indicate that. And what's another thing that's interesting is that often tracks will appear in the fossil record before the body fossils. So you see the tracks on one layer, and then a little later, as you move up, you'll see the bones, you'll see the whole bodies. And that's just sort of interesting, but it may indicate maybe that would happen in a flood. The animals are running around, they're scared, and the flood's coming, and they leave their tracks, and those are covered pretty quickly, and then later you see their bodies. Also, it's been noted that there are maybe distinct characteristics of these tracks that are just sort of interesting. They're pretty sharp, and they're well-defined, indicating that they, were made in wet sediment. It's been proposed that most of these tracks they seem to be running uphill. That's just the indication as you look at that. And sometimes they even seem like they're angled as if walking in one direction while bracing against a current in another direction. There are those kinds of features. And so you see these kinds of markings, and again, it makes you wonder. Okay, was something going on a global scale? And then there's the dating evidence, and this is another hard one. This is a challenge for me, because you date those rocks through some sort of radioisotope dating method, and you do receive old ages. And the idea, the whole method is that there can be an unstable parent radioactive isotope that decays into a more stable daughter isotope, and you know the decay rate and the half-lives in between those, and you can kind of measure the beginning quantity and the end quantity and understand the rate, and you can come up with an age. And that's the whole idea. And so there are these kinds of dating methods that, again, seem to yield very, very old ages. And so what's the response to that, and how do those who are flood proponents respond to that? Well, a lot of the idea is that those methods are challenged because there are certain assumptions that are made. That's the idea, that there are assumptions made about the beginning quantities and the end quantities and the rate, whether or not that remains the same, or if that's affected, or if there can be some kind of contamination. And so there are a lot of reasons that people question those dates, especially when different methods can give sometimes wildly different dates from the same samples. But aside from that, I think there are other methods that at least indicate that things are pretty recent, pretty young. Let me just go through three examples. There would be lots of these kinds of examples, but let me just go through three. And I'm gonna actually do this pretty quick. And I want to mention salt in the sea, sediment on the seafloor, and erosion of the continents. So let me just summarize. So similarly, there are rates of these different processes, and there are presumed starting quantities and ending quantities, and so then you can come up with an age. And so when you look at things like the amount of salt in the sea, and you understand how much salt supposedly is coming into the sea from all of our rivers, and the mechanisms that remove salt, like salt spray, from the oceans, and you calculate that rate, and it gives you a pretty young age. That the maximum age of the ocean supposedly is 42 million years. Now, of course, that's the maximum, assuming that there was no salt to begin with. But that's much younger, obviously, than the 3 billion year proposal that is often proposed. Or similarly with the sediment on the seafloor, as we understand how much sediment is being deposited, how it could be removed through plate movement and subduction of plates, and the maximum age there would be supposedly 12 million years, and also the erosion of the continents, that it seems like our continents are eroding, of course, through weathering, and so a little bit is removed year after year after year. And the idea is that there could be that they would disappear in about 10 million years. So there are these different kinds of methods that, again, are just intriguing. And they give you a little bit of pause, and they make you wonder, okay, was there something else going on? Okay, was there actually a flood that swept across the world? I think it's at least something to consider. But let's keep moving. And we're going to go next to reason number four, and I'm actually going to skim over this one really quickly. But it's the emergence of civilization, and this is complicated too. I think I've discovered that. But as you just try to trace the history of things and the emergence of different aspects of civilization, it can get a little tricky there. And yet, it really seems like a lot came about, a lot emerged. Civilization and aspects of civilization like agriculture and writing, they came about just a few thousand years ago. And this emergence may correlate pretty well with Noah and his family disembarking from the ark and then the dispersion of people at the Tower of Babel, which Perry will cover next week. Okay, so that's just intriguing. Fifthly, I just want to talk about the preponderance of flood legends from all around the globe, and I think this is also interesting, and that there are over 200 various legends from all corners of the globe, from the Americas and from Europe and from Asia and Africa, and just really everywhere there can be legends that describe some sort of worldwide flood. Let me give you a few examples. Just read the summaries. So there's a Hawaiian legend that says a man named Nu'u made a great canoe with a house on it and filled it with animals. The waters came up over all the earth and killed everyone but Nu'u and his family. There's a Chinese legend that says a flood was caused by an argument between a crab and a bird. Fuhi, his wife, three sons, and three daughters escaped a great flood and were the only people alive on the earth. After the great flood, they repopulated the world. There's a Central Asian legend that says Nama was commanded to build an ark, but his eyesight was failing, so his sons built an ark on a mountain. Birds and animals were driven there by rising waters. Nama released a raven, crow, rook, and finally a dove, which returned with a birch twig in its beak. So these are examples of some of these legends. Again, there are over 200 of them from all around the world. And it just makes you wonder, how did that happen? Okay, what led to that? There are similarities in these stories. Obviously, a lot of the details are different, but there are details that seem to be consistent in most of these legends. Details such as these. There was an angry god or gods. The earth was destroyed by a flood. One righteous person was saved. A vessel was built. Animals boarded the vessel, a small group of people survived. Those are consistent details that are found in most of these legends. And you just wonder again, how did that happen? It seems like these places are pretty disconnected from each other. Some of the explanations, in my opinion, don't explain very well. And could it be that there was an actual event here? And then after that dispersion at Babel, that story was taken to different places, and then those stories tended to devolve a little bit, and the details were changed, but the core of the story tended to remain as it spread all around the globe. Well, I think that may have happened. So with all that said, I think there is reason to believe that a flood actually happened, that something like what is described here in Genesis 6 through 9 really did happen. Now, I want to draw some implications there. Before we do that, though, we're going to get to our kids' question. Okay? So, as a reminder, we ask a kids' question each week. This is for 7 through 12-year-olds, since they're in the service with us during the summer. And so I'm going to put a question up on the screen, and then you can raise your hand, and I'm going to try to identify somebody that raises their hand quickly, and then a mic will be taken to you, and you can tell us your name and then give us the answer. And if you get the answer correct, then you can win this Action Bible. Okay, so here's the question. How many days was Noah on the ark? I think back here, I think I saw a rough hand go up.
Right here?
Yep, in the blue there.
Okay, why don't you tell us your first name and your age, okay?
My name is Isaac.
Your age?
10. 150?
No, that is an important number in the flood, but it's not 150. Any other ideas? Okay, I think I saw back here. I think your son.
Ethan, okay, let's do it. What's your name?
My name is Ethan, and I am 10 years old, and I think it's 370.
There you go, that's right. There you go, that's right. 370 days Noah was on the ark. A lot of those days, the majority of those days, he was grounded waiting for God to release him. Okay. So, I think there is some reason to believe that a flood actually happened, but then we ask ourselves, what if it did? What if it really did happen? You know, I think coming to a belief that it actually did happen has changed a lot for me. Because I see things differently. And when I look around this world and I see evidence of God's judgment, then there's just this kind of sobriety that settles upon me. And I feel small, and God feels really big. And there's kind of a good feeling there. My smallness and his bigness, I think that's really important, to see God for who he is, and it challenges me. And again, there is an appropriate kind of fear there that I think should be stirred in each one of us. If God really did destroy the world because of its wickedness, then that should make us ask questions about ourselves, both individually and collectively. And how does God see things? And we can't trifle with God. And we can't treat him real casually. And there's just a seriousness to reality and to our faith that is taken on. And when I examine the evil inclinations in my own heart and understand how God treats evil, again, there is an appropriate fear that I think should settle upon me. And yet at the same time, that's not the fullness of the story, and that's not the fullness of who God is. But we could add a 10th point to our list here, and we could say God rescues. Yeah, that's a lot of the point of the story, too. Yes, God judges, and God judges severely, but he also rescues. God is a rescuer. He delivers. He's a savior. Of course, much of the point of the story is that he provided a way. He provided a covering, a protection for Noah and his family and the animals, and he shielded them from his wrath. Okay, so God rescues, God saves. Unfortunately, we haven't gotten an opportunity to really dig into Genesis chapter 9. I think there are some important ideas in that chapter. But let me just read the summary of God's covenant, the covenant that he makes with Noah. God said, "This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh." And so God makes this covenant. He makes this promise to Noah. And he says, "I will not destroy and judge in this way again." And I wonder how that would have hit Noah after witnessing all of that destruction. If there would have been such a comfort here, but a comfort that depended fully upon God keeping his promise. Okay, God establishing that covenant. Noah seeing God as a covenant maker and a covenant keeper. Okay, that God would withhold that kind of judgment. That's who God is. He promises. And he holds his hand of judgment back, or he restrains it in some ways. And that is the God that of course still exists and that still relates to us. The God who rescues and the God who makes promises and the God who restrains his justifiable wrath in some ways. And he offers us a deliverance as well. I want to read how the book of Hebrews describes Noah. It says, "By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith." So he became an heir of the righteousness. He inherited righteousness. God promised an eternal righteousness, and a protection and a hope and life. And Noah was able to receive that, but he received it by faith, is what it says. Okay, the righteousness that comes by faith. Noah obviously expressed a faith. Okay? He understood that there was a judgment that was coming, because God rightfully judges evil. And he also understood that he could not escape that judgment himself. Okay, this flood was going to be too great for him. He couldn't just outclimb it to the highest of mountains. He couldn't outswim it. He said, "Maybe if I get to the top of the mountain and then just hold on and tread water for a little while, I'll be okay." No, he knew that wasn't going to work. The only chance of survival that he had was to yield, submit, trust God, and enter into what God, the protection that God had offered him. To enter the vessel that God knew how to create and that would shield him from this overwhelming judgment. Okay, that was the faith that Noah applied here. So I'm going to trust God, even though this seems crazy. This is my only chance. I can't do it myself. I can't climb out of this. I can't outswim it. I just have to entrust myself to God and enter into his protection. And that's what Noah did. And the same is true of us. Same is true of us. There is an overwhelming judgment that could descend upon us. And we cannot overcome it ourselves, no matter what we do to try to outrun it or avoid it or do enough to turn it back. No, we have to just enter into God's safety and trust him fully. I'd like to read Ephesians 2, 1 through 5. And as I'm reading, band, you can actually come on back up for our final song. Ephesians 2, 1 through 5, "And you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. This just kind of reaffirms, I think, what was indicated in Genesis chapter 6. We are by nature children of wrath, like everybody is. Verse 4, though, but God. We're children of wrath, but God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. Again, we deserved wrath. There is evil in each one of us. God in his holiness should punish that. He can't just ignore. He can't sweep under the rug. He should punish that. And yet he provided a way for that wrath to be curbed, to be redirected. And Jesus took that upon himself. And Jesus took all the punishment that we deserve. And what God invites us to do is to hide ourselves in Jesus. It's like the ark is this foreshadowing, almost like this type of Jesus. And God invites us to hide ourselves in Jesus to protect us from the wrath that is deserved and to avoid that judgment, to be saved, to be delivered, and to have the hope of eternal life. And I just want to encourage all of us to consider that. What if this story really happened? What if it demonstrates that God truly judges, but what if it also demonstrates that God rescues and that he's offered us a way out, and he's offered us a way that we couldn't figure out ourselves, but he offers us protection and salvation, and that his grace overcomes that judgment.